And I really kind of am disheartened by the fact that some people have chosen to make this a political issue. And it's really not. It's really based upon, you know, this disease outbreak, and it's not going to change until we can get a handle on the biosecurity measures that we're putting or trying to put in place to make sure that this doesn't continue to happen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Shop Talk episode of FP Next, powered by John Deere. I'm one of your co-hosts for this farmer and rancher-driven podcast, Sarah McNaughton-Peterson, and I'm here with Kurt Arnes.
Hi, Sarah. Yes, we're powered by John Deere, so for all of your equipment and technology needs, see your local Deere dealer. So, Sarah, I got back from Commodity Classic a little while ago out in Denver, and the weather was beautiful out in the Rockies. When we were there, got to talk with some folks from John Deere. So we're going to run some segments from those conversations later on in the podcast. But man, we've been on a roller coaster ride for the weather, you know, on the Plain States, right?
Yeah, it's one day it'll be 65, and then the next day it'll be 15 and like 30 mile an hour winds. And I know like this weekend as we're recording this, there's supposed to be this wintry mix they keep calling it, but you guys have gotten a lot more snow this spring than you have. Didn't you get 8 inches of snow the other day right around your place?
Yeah, we got about 8 inches. And the thing is, in Nebraska, it can't snow without wind. And so it seems like, you know, the last month or so, every time we get a couple of flakes of snow, we also have a 60 mile an hour wind that, you know, makes driving a little difficult when you can't see the road. And it sounds like that's what's coming again this next week. So, you know, welcome to spring, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's dry up here for sure. So I wouldn't mind. I was like, oh, some nice spring rains. That'd be great. The pastures would look beautiful. The soil moisture would be fantastic. Just not the snow and especially not the ice. But I think we're maybe past it, and watch me eat my words if we end up getting as much snow as they think we're going to get this weekend. But, you know, it's just one of those things. But talking a little bit about our topic today, we got some intro stuff to talk about and some fun things and some fun stories. And Kurt, you've had all of your kids go through 4-H and FFA. And remind me, did any of them ever show chickens, or did you always have backyard chickens run around your farm?
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, we had about 400 laying hens, and it was my job, I think when I was even in kindergarten, was to go gather eggs every day. We had a farm permit number, and we washed them, put them in cases, and then sold them to the local grocery store, you know, and eggs back then, so, you know, we know what egg prices are right now, okay? So back then on the farm, I looked it up, and we were getting about 23 cents a dozen off the farm back. And this is, you know, would be in the 70s, early 70s, I guess. So, yeah, I grew up around chickens. I swore when I went to college that if I ever came back to the farm, we would never have another chicken on the farm as long as I live, because my job in getting the eggs wasn't such a big deal. It was cleaning the chicken barn, because there our barn doors weren't wide enough for a skid loader. It was all, you know, done with a pitchfork and a tine scoop. And so I swore, but lo and behold, yes, the kids have had 4-H and FFA chickens and ducks, and we do have a little backyard flock.
I know. I always love chickens, right? And so I started out with 6 chickens back when I was a 4-H'er, and this was my end because I wanted every animal I could possibly get my hands on to show. And of course, we had like that little 3-acre, like it's a quote-unquote hobby farm. It was just 3 acres that my parents would let me have things as I had convinced them. And so I had these like Red Star, Rhode Island Red mixes chicks from Tractor Supply. My dad built this little coop for them that was just barely big enough for the 6 to fit in. And he told me I was going to have these 6 chickens that I was able to show them. And when they were old and gone and stopped laying eggs, I would be done with my chickens. But of course, lo and behold, kind of like you, by the time I left for college, I actually had about 40 chickens that my parents got to inherit. And he hates to admit it, my dad does, but he got pretty fond of those birds, and they'd be out there getting the eggs and like cleaning everything out. And they just like to putter around the backyard with those chickens. So it's always pretty fun.
Yeah. Now we have chickens and ducks, and both of my sons like showing ducks at the fair with 4-H and FFA, and we've got some pecans and some call ducks are kind of our favorites, but you know, there's something about having the backyard chickens. There's really nice to have those eggs in the fridge whenever you need to. Although, in the past few years, our laying hens go on strike in the wintertime when it gets really cold. And we've tried all kinds of different things to keep them laying. But, you know, now that spring has arrived, we're getting our fair share again. And thank goodness, gosh, the price of eggs in the store is a little bit high. And so it's good timing on their part, I guess.
Absolutely. I know I didn't even purely do it for egg production. I was like, I want to show these chickens. And so I had like bantam Orpingtons and I had lavender Orpingtons. I drove all the way down into South Dakota to pick up these purple chickens that I was so excited about. I spent a lot more money on those chicks than I ever did on eggs. But I'm actually a poultry judge here in North Dakota. And so I've judged at several county fairs over the years. And I've judged everything from, of course, like chickens and geese and one-time turkeys. And bless this 4-H-er. He did such a great job showcasing his birds. But one of those turkeys had an absolute meltdown on the judging table. And I thought that bird was about to like fly the coop, fly out of the fairgrounds. And I felt so bad of watching this young 4-H-er and his family trying to catch this turkey that had actually bit me and like gotten out of my hands because it was a large turkey and I never judged them before. And I was just trying to do my best. This is my first year as a poultry judge and they got him caught and that 4-H-er still got a blue ribbon because he had great, great birds. They just have a mind of their own, kind of like you were talking about them going on strike and them flying away. They want to do what they want to do and they will.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the reason that Zach always liked ducks, because they generally don't bite, and he's shown pekins before. He really is fond, and I am too, of the call ducks, because they're smaller, easy to handle, and they're very docile. I mean, you can hold them in your arms and they're just about as sweet as an animal can be. And so the best story I have at showing at the fair was, I think when Ben was like in fifth grade, he had a call duck, and you know, he just fell in love with that little duck. And lo and behold, we got to the county fair and he got grand champion, beat his older brother out, by the way. And so you should have seen the smile on his face with that trophy. That was kind of a big deal.
I know. I love those kinds of stories and they're just so fun. Right. And that was like one of my favorite things. And that's what we're talking about today, is kind of the chickens, the poultry industry, as we're talking about our backyard bird introductions. But kind of like we already mentioned a little bit, is why are consumers seeing such high egg prices today in stores? And so egg prices once again soared in February, jumping almost 10.5% on a seasonally adjusted basis in February. Eggs nationally cost $6.85 a dozen as of March 7th, according to the USDA. And there were some stats shared in a Farm Futures article, which of course that story will be linked in the episode description, talking a little bit more about it. And I always go grocery shopping almost exclusively at Costco. But lately, there's either been an empty rack where the eggs used to be, and I just miss them. And there's always like that limit of one per person or two per person. But last time I went to get eggs at the regular grocery store, I paid about $11 for 18 eggs. But how's the egg pricing front been in Nebraska, Kurt? Or maybe you're raking it in with your hens, maybe.
Well, we actually, you know, have our own eggs, just enough really right now for our own family. But I do watch the price of eggs in the grocery store. And yeah, you know, everybody was complaining when they were $5. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're $8 a dozen. It's just almost crazy. We just did a story in Nebraska Farmer, and a bunch of us Farm Progress and Farm Press editors have been writing about this too, because I think there's, you know, a lot of consumers complaining on the mainstream media, not farm media, but mainstream media, about the price of eggs, not understanding, you know, why behind, you know, the egg prices. And that's what we're going to really dig into here today.
Of course, Kurt, the U.S. poultry industry is one of the largest in the world and an important sector of our ag economy. And disease outbreaks such as high path can devastate flocks, impact trade, cause job and financial losses, and of course, affect prices on eggs, poultry, and other staples. And so one of those things that USDA and their Defend the Flock program is really preaching on to help protect these chickens and our egg prices is practicing biosecurity each and every single day, reducing the risk of disease to people, animals, equipment, or vehicles who might be carrying in those diseases onto your property. They just kind of sneak on kind of in all these different ways. And then that'll help protect from backyard flocks to commercial poultry flocks and even into some of our dairy herds. Absolutely. You know, one person is keeping on top of the highly pathogenic avian influenza, of course, which is the reason behind those high egg prices, is our colleague Jennifer Keel, who is a senior editor of Michigan Farmer and Ohio Farmer.
Yep. Jennifer has worked with Farm Progress since 2003, and she shares top insights for local farmers and producers. And yes, we have her joining us today to visit with us about the reason behind those increasing egg prices. So, Jennifer, welcome to FP Next.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. And can you just start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background and what you cover in your position?
Sure. Hi, Sarah and Kurt. Thanks for having me. I am Jennifer Keel. I'm the senior editor for Michigan Farmer and Ohio Farmer Online. And those two publications have been blended into the print version of American Agriculturist. That's my current position. And I've been here for almost 22 years. It'll be in August. And prior to that, I served on I served as editor for some local newspapers, both daily and weekly. Then I went to work for Michigan Farm Bureau in their communications department. I also was the editor of their publication. And then I spent about 3 years with Michigan Agribusiness Association as a communications director there, as well as American Farmland Trust before I landed with Michigan Farmer back in, 2001? Two? I don't remember now.
So Jennifer, in your coverage, you know, we read a lot of your stuff from Michigan and Ohio Farmer online. And I was wondering if you got a few favorite stories that maybe you've covered over the past few months that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Well, the last few months I've been busy with both the Michigan Master Farmers and the Ohio Master Farmers, which is our highest honor we bestow on our farmers. And it's really a great time of the year. It's in the middle of winter when we're doing these interviews, but it gives a nice break to really bring the farm message back and to deep dive into pretty much the whole life. And because the award is given for an entire service, and not just to their family, their community, the agricultural community. And so it's really great to visit with these farmers. There's always something to learn from them. And they somehow find an extra hour in the day that I have no idea how they do. And then in visiting, one of my master farmers led to a really interesting story. He was telling me about this concert that they have in the hay field that benefits his local Hastings High School band program. So I was learning about this when I was interviewing for the Master Farmer. So the next year when that concert came up, he invited me to come down and cover it. And so I went to that, and it was just amazing to see, you know, 600 people out in the middle of a hay field listening to this concert, which unbelievably was great, out in the middle of an open air field. It sounded awesome. And they raised like $12,000 for this program. So again, it shows just these master farmers and how wonderful they are and how deeply they care, not only about making money, but also benefiting the industry and their communities. And so that one just sort of touched me.
We always love to hear about the community involvement. I think that's one of our favorite things we always talk about, is how much farmers and ranchers give back to their rural community, and especially for those school programs. But turning a little bit the topic, there's a lot of different facts or some misinformation everyone's been seeing about the price of eggs lately. I know when I went to the store last, I paid like $11 for 18 eggs. And I was like, what in the world? But of course, we know what's going on. But what can you tell our listeners about why we're seeing some of those increased egg prices?
Sure, Sarah. Michigan and Ohio, which I mostly concentrate on, I should say that American Agriculturist covers 13 states, including the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, Michigan and Ohio. I mostly concentrate on Michigan and Ohio, and we've had a huge outbreak in avian flu this past year. So just to give you a little bit of concept of what's going on here, Ohio in the last 2 months has lost upwards of 15 million birds. Now, those are not all egg layers, but a lot of them are. There's also turkeys in there and egg pullets. Michigan, in middle of March-ish last year, lost about 6.5 million egg layers. So when you're taking, and that's just two states, and neither one of those states are the leaders of egg production, but they are high up there. Ohio's like third, and I think Michigan's seventh. But when you take that kind of production, or the lack of production, out of a supply and demand system, you're going to have, when the supply is not there, the demand is still going to be there. So what's going to happen? The price is going to go up. And I really kind of am disheartened by the fact that some people have chosen to make this a political issue. And it's really not. It's really based upon, you know, this disease outbreak. And it's not going to change until we can get a handle on the biosecurity measures that we're trying to put in place to make sure that this doesn't continue to happen. This isn't the first time the U.S. has had avian flu, and I can't tell you the exact year. I think it maybe was 2018 or a little bit before that. But we managed to put a stop to it then, and I have a belief that we'll be able to get it under control again. This current outbreak has been going on since January of 22. So now we're into our third year of this, and hopefully we can see some reductions coming. The federal government has made some big investments recently.
So Jennifer, I'm in Nebraska, and we are a big poultry state, and we've lost millions of laying hens over the last while. I just heard a couple of days ago, our director of our Department of Agriculture in our state was saying that we've only had 4 backyard flocks, you know, this year, but previously last fall was really hard on some of the commercial flocks in Nebraska and a lot of the surrounding states. So, you know, there's a increased interest in backyard flocks because of the cost of eggs in the store. You know, if you had some tips maybe for some folks who are interested in, you know, getting their own chickens or kind of keeping that biosecurity under control, do you, have you got some ideas on that side of it?
I don't really have a lot of direction on what backyard flocks can do. I'm really not sure what they can do if they're open in the air, because they've seen that this, you know, is being brought in by migrant birds mostly. At least that's how it's been. That's the theory. So I don't know if it's truly been proven, but so as far as backyard flocks, that becomes tough, I think, to try to secure your chickens, you know, especially if you got them out in the yard. Our commercial producers have really put lots of measures in. Nothing comes on that farm without going through a gate, without being, some of them are washing underneath, some are washing tires. I mean, these are all indoor facilities. So they've got their workers changing out their clothes, putting protective gear on. They've looked at ventilation systems. They've looked at making sure water is clean water coming in, making sure feed supplies are being checked and appropriate. So as far as backyard flies, I think you're really kind of at the mercy of the environment.
I don't know about you, Kurt, and we were going to talk a little bit about the backyard flocks, because I'm a big chicken person, right? When I was growing up, I had a bunch of chickens. I'm a poultry judge here in North Dakota. I love them. But it's always so different, because sometimes they're like fenced in and they can't get any contact with wild birds. And sometimes they're just out free ranging, which we always do with our chickens. And there would be random ducks or random geese that'd be landing around. It's really hard in a lot of those situations to kind of keep that contact, kind of like mitigate it. But what have you been seeing from like recent farmers? Have any farmers been sharing anything with you about like how high path is affecting their farms?
Well, like I said, Ohio and Michigan have been decimated by this. And some of these operations, I'm not saying that they don't have good biosecurity. Many of them do. I mean, huge biosecurity with many of the practices that I mentioned earlier. They haven't totally pinpointed how it's getting into these closed facilities. So it could be, you know, it could be aerial. Many of them have done everything that the government has asked them to do and more. They don't want to depopulate their flocks. That's not in their best interest. It's not in their customers' best interest to have that disruption. Yes, they are being compensated for any depopulated animals, but there's a downtime that they're not being compensated for. They have to go through and completely clean these facilities. And then there's an approval process that has to an inspection, and before they can even begin to bring birds back in. So it's not a good thing for anybody.
I know on the sanitation side, which you just, talked about, I've even seen the propane folks looking at, you know, some of the flamers that they can use to maybe sanitize poultry litter, you know, and inside some of these barns. So there's all kinds of different innovations that may come out of this that'll hopefully improve biosecurity for, you know, poultry farmers in particular. It's a big deal. At Commodity Classic a couple of weeks ago, Secretary Rollins, it was one of the first things that she talked about, you know, was USDA trying to come up with a good plan to kind of take care of avian influenza. However, you know, it's been found in so many other species. Dairy in particular has been, on the radar with bird flu. So how about the dairies in Michigan and Ohio, some of the dairy farmers that you've talked to, how are they dealing with those same situations? And what's the situation in those states on the dairy side?
Well, we've had several dairies test positive in Michigan, and obviously that's disappointing, and they think it's being passed through, you know, exposure to that milk. It's causing reduced milk production. It's some cases, some aborted calves, fever, stiff manure. And then there was one farmer that Chris Torres actually interviewed in Michigan, of all things, because he was speaking out east, and he said he actually had to cull 5% of his herd and suffered about $100,000 in damages because of avian flu. And I think that the branch to the bovine industry, and because no animals have really been killed because of avian flu, the impact hasn't been really talked much about or explained. And Chris actually went into that quite well in his story, that there's real damage occurring in our dairy herds as well. And then we've got, you know, it has crossed over to humans. So now we got like 70 human cases, USDA's reporting through CDC, that, and we've had one death because of avian flu. So this is really, and what continues to be the biggest concern of all is if this virus becomes a jumper and it becomes jumping from when human to human. That is the biggest impetus for getting something done about this, not just because of the mass losses we've had in our animals, but should this take that jump from human to human, which it has not done yet, we're going to have a serious issue. We're going to have a serious pandemic, not unlike potentially COVID-19.
I know we were just revisiting the other day, me and my husband, because we met during the COVID era, and we realized it's been 5 years since that lockdown and kind of how the whole US and the world shut down. But I know it's nice to see that the FDA and the CDC say that it's a low risk to humans right now for the avian influenza, since it is mostly sticking to those wild birds, poultry and dairy cattle, and those couple human cases. And it's one question I heard from one of my friends was they were avoiding eating eggs because they didn't want to get bird flu from the eggs. And what in your research and what you've been visiting with have you seen? I hope eggs are safe. I've got a bunch of them in my fridge I paid a lot of money for. So
you got eggs in your freeze, use them away. There's nothing wrong with eggs. This disease does not penetrate the eggs, and even exposure to the shell has been, you know, minimal. As far as I know, there's been no reported cases of anybody getting sick from eating eggs. So make sure you keep those. Those are like gold in your refrigerator.
They absolutely are.
There's all sorts of TikToks and stuff on social media. It is kind of funny, but it's not. But about how the eggs are the new gold standard, you know, the people. You better make sure when you open your egg carton up in the grocery store, everybody's checking to make sure there's not one cracked, because, or somebody, you know, their $10 cookie, because, you know, you got to have eggs for cookies. And I don't know. It's a little nuts, but at the same time, I think there is some end to this in sight. And I think that as we, USDA has, you know, just rolled out, Secretary Rollins announced that, you know, there's $500 million coming in to help with this situation. And, you know, part of that $400 million is going to go to producers to try to make sure, you know, they have the best biosecurity facilities that they can. And there's another $100 million for research. And then there's also some money going into looking at vaccines and therapeutical tools and other innovative solutions. However, I did see Secretary Rollins step back after this announcement. She came back about a week later and announced that they are not pursuing vaccines for chickens at this point because of the trade implications. And so that's kind of on hold, even though there was a vaccine approved in mid-February for temporary use, I believe, if that's what they call it. But it never made it to the market at this point. And according to Rollins, it doesn't look like it's going to get any movement anytime soon. Well, I was going to talk about the prices of eggs a little bit, because back in 2021, the average price of a dozen eggs was $1.79. Today, it is like about $7 a dozen, if you can find them. And then, like Sarah said, maybe upwards to $11 or $12 a dozen. And so USDA is recognizing that that's really putting a hurt on certain businesses, particular businesses that not only households, but businesses that use eggs immensely. I mean, eggs are in a lot of stuff. Eggs are in ice creams, are in cookies, they're in your French toast. I mean, you know, eggs are the foundation for a lot of things. And so the USDA said that they're going to bring in some, they're going to actually import some eggs from other countries to help with this temporary, hopefully temporary situation where our supply and demand is so out of whack.
So those eggs in Sarah's refrigerator are just like the Willy Wonka eggs. They're just actually made of gold, right? So you have to really take good care of those. So, you know, I'm going to turn the page just a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, you know, since you've been covering Michigan agriculture and Ohio agriculture for so long, you know, your area has some very unique crops and you've covered some really neat stuff over the past few years that we've been reading. Can you tell us, you know, about some of the unique things about Michigan agriculture in particular that I think some of the crops that are grown that maybe we're not as familiar with in North Dakota and Nebraska?
Oh, that's a great question, Kurt. Thanks. You know, Michigan is the second most diverse state in the country behind California. We grow almost upwards of 300 different type of commodities, everything from apples and blueberries and peaches to cucumbers, squash, onions, potatoes, sugar beets. Of course, we got a huge dairy now, our dairy industry. Dairy likes Michigan. We have a good climate for dairy. And, you know, of course, we have our poultry industry. We got an expansion of our turkey processing and production facilities going on right now. We are the cherry capital of the world. So we have an abundance of tart cherries in particular. You know, everything from sweet peas to dry beans. Our dry beans are a big thing, especially black beans. They are a hot commodity and desired product of Mexico. We ship a lot of dry beans down there because of the particular qualities of our beans and canning and also taste. So, yeah, we're pretty proud that Michigan has quite the diversity here. You can go on one side of the state, pick up a whole bushel of peaches and come back over here and get some string beans. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot here. It's wonderful. And if nobody's come to Michigan before, come for our ag products, but also come for our nature. We have lots of water, lots of activities, lots of things to do, beautiful scenery. And of course, we got the Mackinac Bridge and the Mackinac Island and the UP and its great vastness, waterfalls, and you know, a lovely Lake Superior.
You know, Kurt and I always like to talk about the national parks. And Kurt, remember we were talking about Isle Royale? That's in Michigan. So maybe we should be taking a trip out to Michigan. And I also saw what I was surprised is that Michigan leads the nation in asparagus production. Have you ever seen an asparagus field or like how those operations grow?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen asparagus field. It was one of my first jobs as a teenager to go out and plant asparagus. And, you know, those little sandy soils and those sand bugs and burrs that are in there are not fun. And when you're like 14, it was a great point of, it was a job, so it was money. But no, yes, I'm very familiar with asparagus. It's one of my favorite vegetables. I love when it comes into season. And yeah, Michigan has an abundance of it, thankfully. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of turmoil that's headed for some of these specialty crops as we see, you know, labor prices go up. And then there's this big push for land. So not only for solar and wind, but also house development, particularly in those areas. A lot of those areas that grow these specialty crops are on Michigan's west coast, which is right along that Michigan Lake Michigan shoreline where they get that Lake Michigan effect. And some of those areas are also just immensely beautiful. It's just so wonderful. And so there's a big competition between people and production sometimes. I mean, people want to build houses because that place is lovely, but agriculture also wants to be there because it gives us this great environment to grow all these specialty crops. So getting back to your original question though, yeah, I do love asparagus.
it's all about land use, isn't it? I mean, that is kind of one of the policy discussions that we're probably going to be having for decades now, is land use, and that kind of tension between ag and other uses certainly will come into play as we try and feed a larger population, you know, going forward. So there's going to be a lot of policy discussions along that line. I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, was the Mackinac Bridge. And I think I read a really cool story that you wrote about some tractors driving across that bridge. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, Kurt. Thanks for bringing that up, too. Yeah, the Antique Mackinac Bridge crossing is every year. It's the weekend after Labor Day. Generally, they have to get that approved by the Bridge Authority, and that usually comes down about this time of year, so we'll be hearing about it soon. But anybody and everyone can come. You have to belong to a tractor club, which we can give you the details on how to get involved with that. That's for insurance purposes. But every year, there's about 1,500. Think about this. 1,500 antique tractors crossing the bridge. They have to have, of course, rubber wheels. You can't have those spikes out there. And and they have to go a certain miles per hour. You can put a buddy seat on there and have somebody go with you if you want. It's just a lot of fun. And the camaraderie between drivers up there is fantastic. It's just a lot of fun. And I hear every year, I interview many of them, and they're from all parts of the United States. I mean, seriously, I think almost every state has had a tractor there at some point. And I write about them as well, but they all say it checks a bucket list for them. And the one guy I interviewed this past year, he says, I want to put it back in the bucket because I want to do it again. So yeah, the antique tractor crossing is a lot of fun. And anybody who's really into antique tractors, then you would enjoy it. It's an all weekend event. They start bringing their tractors up on like Wednesday, the week before. Then they have a staging area. It's all policed. It's safe. And then they sit there until the Saturday morning crossing. And then they go across the bridge and they stay in Sault Ste. Marie, where they have a staging area there as well. So everybody, it's kind of like a tractor parade with a show afterwards. And then they have tractor games that they have. It's kind of like it's a huge festival.
So Kurt, it sounds like I'll have to go backpacking, and you'll have to go to geek out at all of the antique tractors, because I know that is fully up your alley.
Yeah. And I've got a couple of those old tractors that don't look as nice as the ones that I've seen in pictures that you took, Jennifer, on the Mackinac Bridge. But when, you know, it's kind of in your blood when you grow up on the farm, having those antique tractors. That nostalgia is really strong. And I can only imagine, we've got tractor rides across Nebraska, the antique tractors, but there's nothing like the Mackinac Bridge. And so that had to be quite an experience.
Yeah, it was. And you know, Kurt, your tractor doesn't have to be shiny and pretty. I mean, I've seen it all up there and nobody cares. Everybody's colorblind too. We don't care if you like green, red, yellow, whatever. And if it's rusty, that's okay. If it's prime and pristine, that's wonderful too. There's really, it's a no judgment zone. And so bring your antique tractor.
Kurt, you have to look at how long of a haul that might be. Maybe you'll just have to do, have you guys seen those producers who like drive their antique tractors like across the country, like fundraising for something? Kurt, maybe you will have to take a podcast tour and you can drive one of your tractors up to Michigan to be a part of that. And I will follow you in an actual vehicle and pick you up off the road. That'd be a fun road trip, wouldn't it?
A few years ago, I interviewed a gentleman and his wife who drove their tractor. It was an antique tractor, and they drove it from Venango, Nebraska, which is way down the southwest corner near the Colorado border, all the way up to a second home that they had in Fairbanks, Alaska. And you talk about a tractor trip. And they, you know, the wow. His wife followed him with their motorhome. But the actual story wasn't just the driving. It was, you know, they broke down and they had to rely on, you know, the generosity of people that were also traveling, you know, the Alaska highway. And it was just more of an adventure. And, you know, so there's just something about driving an old tractor around across the country and really seeing. He said, I remember him telling me that he had seen canola before, but he had never seen it like always from a car. never from a tractor, an open air tractor where you could actually see the fields, you know? So that was really special to him. He said you could see the wildlife and everything else. So there's something about being on those old tractors and driving them around.
Yeah, some of the, I did a story a while back, and there's a group that most of the guys that take their tractors up to the bridge, they're trailered up there. But there is a group from Michigan, and it's a ways away. I mean, if you were to drive by car, it's at least a couple hour drive. So you can imagine that, you know, on an antique tractor doing 20, 30 mile per hour, maybe it's going to take you a while. So they, you know, they devote like 2-3 days and they take their time, and they've got certain spots where they stop, and they have restaurants that know they're coming, and they got areas for them to park. And it's just a fun experience. And I think these guys really get a kick out of the attention that they get too, because they get lots of questions. People want to know about the history of their tractor, and people love to talk to me about it when I go up there. And that's part of the reason I love doing it. I like to hear the backstory on where that tractor came from, what it's gone through, what they put into it. You know, did great grandpa have it? Oh, I've done stories where the tractor was sold and then the guy somehow found it like 20 years later and bought it back. And so now he's got his family tractor back. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. I know I love hearing like the stories of the behind the scenes type stories. Even when I know Kurt will be at Husker Harvest Days in that antique tractor area, I always spend longer up there than I ever mean to run around the showgrounds, because I always stop and start talking to people. And then I want to know like the whole story. So I end up sitting there for a while, but I know that we could sit and talk about this for so long. It's so cool to talk about like the diverse ag, because of course in Nebraska and North Dakota, Kurt and I see a lot of corn, soybeans, kind of like those big staple crops, but none of the vegetable crops. And so it's always fun to visit about that, hear a little bit on the poultry production side. But any final thoughts you want to share about High Path with our listeners? Or I know none of us have a crystal ball, and I say this every episode, it'd be so nice if we did so we could know what's going to happen. But what do you think the outlook's going to look like coming up?
Well, we'll get through this. I think it's optimistic. It's going to be, I think we're going to go, from what I've seen from CDC lately, it's kind of settled down. We had a really bad, like from Christmas time through up until right about now. February was really bad in Ohio. Something like, what did we have total? Like 8 million birds, I think. And then like 15 million in just the last 2 months. So I think that, you know, that follows that migratory bird pattern possibly, and hopefully things settle down a little bit. And with the help of the government to step in and give us, some of the growers some additional resources to put some protection in place. We beat it once before. I think we'll beat it again. It's just going to take some time. And consumers are just going to have to, you know, face the fact that eggs are going to be a little more expensive. But at the same time, I also contend that they're some of the cheapest sources of protein. So even at the price that they're at now, and eggs are just so much the foundation of so many other things that it's not like we can give them up. So I think the government's doing the right thing by bringing in, you know, some imports of eggs temporarily, and until we can get things leveled out a little bit, let the supply and demand find a meeting place that we so enjoyed for so many years. So it's like you don't really appreciate something until it's gone sometimes. And I think eggs got a whole new appreciation.
Well, Jennifer, we sure want to thank you for joining us on the podcast today and for all of your insights, not only in the avian influenza, but in, you know, sharing a little bit about Michigan ag and Ohio ag with us. And then we got to talk tractors. So, you know, it's always a good day when we get to do that. So thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Well, Kurt, that about wraps it up for the Shop Talk episode of FP Next, powered by John Deere. Thanks to Jennifer again for joining us and talking about these great growers. And of course, we'll have all those links we discussed in the episode description. And I just want to hit a little bit more on those links. And one of those, like we already talked about, is the USDA's Defend the Flock website, which gives producers and poultry producers or backyard chicken owners to find out what biosecurity practices should be implemented during these times, information on outbreaks from the CDC and the USDA, and of course, those links about Jennifer's stories we covered, and links to Michigan and Ohio Farmer magazines.
Yeah, you'll want to be sure and check those out. So today, to our listeners, we want to thank you for tuning in to this episode of FP Next, allowing us into your tractor cab, your truck, on your farm, in your shop, and in your fields. A special thank you, as always, goes out to our sales, digital, production, and marketing team members who put in a lot of work with us. And if you want to be sure not to miss any top stories, sign up for our Farm Progress Text Blasts, which bring the hot stories right to your inbox.
You can sign up for those text alerts by texting FARM, F-A-R-M, to 20505. Be sure to follow Farm Progress on social media to stay up to date with ag news and more, and check out the digital edition of your regional publication at farmprogress.com. And Kurt, we've got a fun episode coming up next. As always, they're always fun episodes. And we're going to be talking about Elon Musk and what he brings to agriculture, and maybe what ties he has to the agriculture industry. So I think that'll be a fun episode, and we'll see what that discussion entails.
We'll talk about a timely topic, so it's a very important topic, and we're excited to dive in and have that discussion.
Absolutely. And you can follow along with FP Next by listening and subscribing on your favorite podcast platform, or YouTube, or Farm Progress Online. And we ask every single time, but please make sure you leave us a review if you enjoy the show.
But as Sarah always says, it's 5 stars or nothing.
Absolutely. And remember, if it's agriculture, your friends at Farm Progress have you covered. Here's wishing you high yields and good weather. We'll see you next time.